Welcome to Trust Radio, the investment trust podcast brought to you by Janus Henderson Investors. I'm Laura Thomas, and in this episode, I'll be discussing how to get started in investing with Simon Longfellow, the co-founder of StepsToInvesting.com. Steps to Investing is an independent company set up to help people get started on their own investment journeys. This episode is brought to you in association with Janus Henderson Investors. It's for promotional purposes, is not for onward distribution, and the value of an investment can fall as well as rise. Past performance is not a guide to future performance, and nothing in this episode should be construed as advice. Simon, so thank you so much for joining me today. So I guess to get us started, can you tell us a little bit more about Steps to Investing and, you know, what was the rationale for launching it?
Yeah, of course. So Steps to Investing really is about helping inexperienced investors get started with investing. And in terms of why we launched it, I think there are a few things. I mean, one is, and I'm sure we'll come on to talk about this in more detail, one is the fact that lots of people are putting money in bank accounts, in savings accounts, so things like cash ISAs and instant access savings accounts, those kinds of things. And it's not doing a great job for them anymore. You know, 10, 15 years ago, you might have been able to get a decent interest rate on that cash. Less so for the last, you know, 10, 12 years. And as a consequence of that, people are struggling to work out how to, you know, provide an income, provide growth in their investments and their savings. And when you look at that, there's, you know, there's lots of cash. I know Janus Henderson have done some work on this. There's lots of cash sitting in bank accounts going nowhere. And that was kind of the logic. That the problem though is when you go to Google, which is where most people start, you know, type in, how do I get a better rate on my savings? What tends to happen is either, frankly, you've got people who are trying to relieve you of your savings in not a very nice way. And there's quite a bit of kind of get rich quick, you know, we're promising you 12% per annum kind of advertising going on, which inevitably turns out not to be true. Or you end up in sites that aren't really designed for inexperienced investors, and you soon get lost in this kind of world of jargon and complexity that most newbie investors don't really understand. So we think we you know, kind of spotted a niche there to try and help those people just navigate that path, really, you know, trying to find a better return, trying to do it in a sensible kind of long-term way, not about kind of get rich quick, but more around get rich sensibly and slowly over the long term, and try and just help people understand what it is they're doing. You know, we're big believers in the fact that we think that people should understand a little bit about what they're doing and not blindly kind of go into it. Because as I'm sure we'll come on to talk about, there are risks involved, you know, and you need to be aware of those risks when you start investing.
100%. And I think you touched on a couple of really interesting points there. And I think, you know, make for a really good foundation for launching a kind of a research informative website and platform such as Steps, because, you know, people, a lot of people, you know, do kind of think cash is king, you know, that key phrase of, you know, well, I'll keep it in the bank account and I'll keep it safe and it's there for the rainy day. And yes, you know, there is that element of importance, you know, the kind of 3 to 6 months of cash for something, you know, if your boiler breaks, things like that, then absolutely you need to have that easy access to money to fix problems or things like that, or, I know, surprises that you might not have planned for. But equally, when you're looking at the long term, and you kind of mentioned some work that we at Janus Henderson have done looking at the amount of cash there is sitting there, and actually the impact that inflation and things can have on that is huge. So when you are thinking about the longer term, you know, if it's child's ISA, if it's for your pension, you know, these are things that actually being in the stock market or being invested really could potentially be in your favor, obviously notwithstanding the risks and taking into account what would work for your own personal circumstances. So I think it's, you know, it's a really great resource for people to be able to have in order to kind of either get going on their journey, but also to be able to develop it further. And, you know, I think we'll come on to talk about this in a bit more detail, but, you know, you do have experience, a bit of background in financial services and the asset management industry. So, you know, you have that experience to kind of bring in and to help individual investors. And I guess that brings me on really nicely to my next question, really, which is, you know, with this notion that people think cash is king, you know, do you think that a number of people haven't made that decision to invest or haven't dipped their toe in the stock market yet because of the risk element? Do you think they think it's a bit too risky and you know, cash is safe, I should say?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. We're not saying that you shouldn't have some cash, as you say. You know, the received wisdom is sort of 3 to 6 months worth of salary you should have in cash. And I think that was actually highlighted in bold font size 27 when we went into the pandemic, because part of the reason I think that the state got so involved in bailing people out was that people were highly leveraged. They've got lots of, you know, credit, whether that's a mortgage or credit card or loans. And the savings ratio in the UK is not great. So people weren't sitting on, you know, big amounts of cash that would see them through furlough or see them through redundancy or, you know, their job disappearing. And, I really think that the crisis that we've gone through has highlighted the need to have some cash. The problem with it, as you say, is that inflation, so basically the cost of, you know, goods and services that we use going up over time, has been running at, you know, between 1% and 2%, is now, this morning we find out, 3%. And that means that your, you know, £100 needs to be £103 this year to buy the same stuff that you bought last year. And, you know, what's the best rate you can get on cash in a savings account? Well, it's not very good. You know, even if you look at tied in savings accounts where your, you know, your money's away for a year, if you can get 0.5%, even, you know, 1% on a good day, you're doing really well. So that means that essentially your money is going backwards. Now, risk is a really important point, because, you know, what you're saying there is, you know, cash is without risk, it's safe. Well, that's sort of true, in the sense that unless your bank collapses, which is a very rare occurrence, that, you know, that your cash is not going to go anywhere in the short term. The problem is that slowly over time it's eroding. And so, you know, if you're thinking about moving from some cash into investing, what you're swapping at the moment, at any rate, is the certainty of that cash falling in value, because it will, with the possibility of better returns from markets, from investing in the future. And it, you know, I need to be clear, it is a possibility. It's not a certainty that you will, that markets will go up. But if you look at the data over the long term, and again, that's the other thing we should distinguish here, is the distinguish between short-term goals and needs, which cash is great for because it's readily accessible, and long-term goals and needs, things like maybe saving for retirement, saving to retire early, saving for children's educational fees, those kind of 10 to 15 to 20 and beyond year goals are where investing really comes into its own.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'd like to just kind of hone in on that point a bit about long term a little bit, if I may, because I think you're quite right. When we're looking, or when we're considering investments in our investment horizon, you know, those timeframes that you quite rightly mentioned out, sort of 10, 15, you know, 20 years plus, you know, that's the kind of time we're looking at, or at least minimum 5 potentially. So, you know, looking at that, you know, taking that into consideration, if we look at what investing in shares will have done over that time frame. Now, obviously, past performance we know is not a guarantee to future performance. But if we look at sort of what's happened in that time frame, we can see that if you had been invested in the stock market, that has dramatically outperformed what cash will have done, sort of in a cash deposit account or a cash ISA, etc., because of interest rates. And that's both in absolute and in real terms, so i.e. after inflation. So I just wondering if you could maybe talk a bit more, you know, to perhaps quantify the extent of what that outperformance might look like, you know, particularly, let's just say, focusing particularly on the UK.
Yeah, definitely. So I've got some data here from Hargreaves Lansdown. They're an investment platform. In fact, they're the largest platform in the UK for investors. And they have looked at data. This was a study they did last year, and they looked at data going back to 1999, which is when the Bank of England essentially started effectively reporting interest rates on savings. And so that's a 20-year period in essence. If you were to have held your money in an instant access savings account, then over that period, you would have lost money. It wouldn't have kept up with inflation. So your spending power in real terms, as you said, has gone down. If you had a fixed term savings account, so this is where you're locking your money away for a period of time, it could be 1, 3, 5 years, over with those accounts, then if you'd invested £100 or saved £100, should I say, back in 1999, by 2020, it would have grown to £194 in absolute terms. But in taking into account inflation, it would actually only be £128. So 100 becomes 128 over 20 years. If you contrast that to the stock market, so this is UK shares, over the same period, your £100 would have been 432, discounting inflation, but 284 after inflation. So those are the two key numbers to think about there. It's 128 for a fixed rate savings account after inflation, or 284 in stocks and shares in the UK. And that period includes the financial crisis of 2008, 2009. So even when the markets performed terribly and the value of investments dropped dramatically during that period, they, of course, have recovered since. So in fact, the yardstick by which your investments would have outperformed is significant over that time.
No, absolutely. And the difference between those two figures is as you say, it's not insignificant. And as a, you know, as an individual saver, investor, thinking about, as we said earlier, the longer term and things like that, it makes all the difference, doesn't it, really? And it really does impact, you know, your, well, the rest of your financial decisions and what you may be able to go on to do with that money and its use. And I just wanted to come back, because you touched on as well, talking a little bit about the risk of holding money purely in cash on its own. I'd like to just turn to maybe looking a little bit more at the risk that people might need to bear in mind when, you know, they are making investments in the stock market. You know, they are looking to getting involved for the first time, or indeed if they are already involved, you know, what they have to might want to consider as they go through their investment journey.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And we talk about a lot about risk at Steps to Investing, because when you talk to inexperienced investors, one of the three reasons that they don't invest in the stock market is risk, because they don't want to lose all their money. And risk for inexperienced investors is often seen in terms of winning or losing. So it's a bit like going to the casino and putting, you know, your money on red or black. It's win or lose. And that's not actually how risk works in the world of investment management. It's not simply win or lose. It's a much more involved process than that. There is risk, but then there's risk in everything in life, right? So crossing the road involves risk, getting in a car, going on a train, you know, all getting on a plane, not that we're doing that lately, but all of these things involve risk. And you've got to remember that in order to get a return or to increase the chances of a return, you're going to have to take some risks. So you have to accept that as a matter of course when it comes to investing. So the key risks that you need to bear in mind when you start out is that your, let's take the Hargreaves example, your £100 might end up at 284 after inflation, but it might not. And it might end up at zero. That is a possible outcome. Your cash is very unlikely to end at zero. It might get eroded over time, and it will take an awful long time for that cash to be eroded, so it has absolutely no value. But that is a risk when it comes to investing, and that's the primary risk that you need to be comfortable with, that the ride over those 20 years is not going to be necessarily a smooth ride. It's not always going to be up. It's not always going to be down. There's going to be days, weeks, months, even years, in fact, when we are in difficult market circumstances. And the recent crisis is a good example, although things have bounced back to sort of pre-pandemic levels pretty quickly. And I think a lot of that's to do with the government support and stimulus that's been made available. But even after the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, there was a period of a couple of years where markets were very difficult and asset values of investments remained depressed, but it wasn't that long before things came back. So that sort of leads me to my second point, which is that the other risk that you face is timing, really. And that's why professional investors often talk about time in the market rather than trying to time the market. Because that, you know, if you're needing your money out in a short period of time and then something like a global pandemic happens or a financial crisis happens, then you're much less likely to be able to ride out that storm over time. And so you need to be comfortable with the risk that your investments are going to be tied up for a period. And as I said, we think about that as 10 years, as a sensible number. 5 years really is an absolute minimum. I think if you were thinking about a financial goal for less than a five-year period, then really investing is not for you, and you should stick with other cash or cash type investments. Beyond that, I think the other major risk is sticking all of your eggs in one basket. It's a very well used analogy, but it is absolutely true. If you go out and buy a single stock in a single company, or you go out and invest, and I've read so many stories recently of people having done this, you know, put a significant amount of their wealth into a cryptocurrency, for example, a single cryptocurrency, then you are massively exposed. You are absolutely exposed to the movement of that thing, whether it's a company which makes, I don't know, food, or a cryptocurrency which is a store of value, apparently, allegedly. You're going to be massively exposed to that thing. And so at Steps to Investing, we really champion the idea of not doing that and investing in what are called collective investments. It's just a bit of jargon. What it means is that rather than buying one company's shares, you are actually buying shares or investments in a number of different companies across different industries, across different sectors, even different geographies. And that should help mitigate that risk of just, you know, going for red, going for black, because that's where you will almost certainly get your fingers burnt.
Absolutely. And that's really, you know, that's the point of, you know, that last point you're referring to there is diversification, isn't it? And
you know,
making sure that people have, again, depending on their personal circumstances and their end goals, to help mitigate that risk that they may see, is that diversification across, you know, asset classes, you know, whether that's things like property, equities, perhaps even sort of, you know, other slightly maybe more illiquid, so less sellable, I suppose, assets in the market. But then that mixed with, you know, the opportunity to be able to access that through different geographies as well. So, you know, you're not just, you know, perhaps all invested in the UK, for example, but, you know, have some exposure to the US market, Asia Pacific, Europe, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, to be able to have that more global approach as well. And I guess actually that's something that I'd just quite like to turn to just very, very quickly here is, you know, the ability for an individual to be able to do that. As you say, they don't necessarily have to, you know, if you are a first time investor or doing so, you don't have to get that diversification by going and buying individual stocks or companies across the world or different markets either, you know. And I know that on the Steps website, you guys, you know, brilliantly talk and give more information about things like open-ended funds, but also investment trusts. Now, obviously at Janus Henderson, we manage investment trusts and we have a range available across different asset classes. But I just wondered if, you know, from your perspective, if you could talk a bit more about those options that are available for people and why they may be a consideration for them potentially for that diversification aspect, or indeed, you know, other potential reasons why they may want to look at them.
There are essentially three different types of collective investment. And when you go and research this, you'll hear all kinds of jargon and different names for different things, and it gets super complicated super quickly. But when you boil it down, there are essentially three different structures. There's the investment trust, the open-ended fund, and then there are exchange-traded funds or ETFs. There are essentially three different structures in which you can invest. And there are different flavors, as I say, and different complexities, but they're all essentially dealing with that aspect of diversification risk in some way or other, because none of those things is only going to buy shares in one company or buy, you know, a single bond or buy a single property or what, you know, whatever it is. They're all going to be, to some extent, diversified. And that varies wildly. So there are some fund managers who run really short lists. I know, you know, Henderson European Focus Trust, for example, John Bennett runs a pretty tight list of 45 or less than 45 shares in his portfolio, all European companies, whereas something like Bankers Investment Trust is a, you know, it's a global investment and therefore almost by definition has much more scope for investment because it's looking around the world. And I think, you know, there are over 100 investments in that portfolio. So they all do that diversification thing, but they do it to greater or lesser degrees. And that really comes down to the mandate for the investment. So when you're looking at investment, you can very quickly, it's usually called an objective somewhere on the fund manager's website. And it'll tell you, usually in pretty straightforward language, what it's setting out to do. You know, where is it investing in the world? Is it just Europe? Is it globally? Is it just the UK? What's it aiming to achieve? And this is a really important point, actually, because investments generally can do one of two things. They can either generate an income, so that's dividends being paid out, sometimes quarterly, sometimes half yearly, sometimes annually. So income type investments or growth type investments. So that's the value of your money growing over time. And actually, you can get investments that do a blend of those things. So they'll provide some income and some prospect of growth. And those are really the three main objectives. And when you, as I say, when you look at the mandate for the investment, it will tell you what it's aiming to do and how it goes about doing that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's probably worth just saying, isn't it, that I think that, as you say, you've got kind of those, maybe those three main objectives, so the income and growth and the combination of the two, which is often referred to as sort of that total return aspect of it as well, isn't it? Absolutely. And so I guess, you know, that follows on really quite nicely to my next question, really, which is, given all of that information that's out there and, you know, all of those things that are available for someone who is starting out or is thinking about doing so and saying to themselves, I want to make my money work harder for me. I'm looking at a 15-year time horizon for it. What do you say to beginners? You know, what's the kind of your view on how to get going?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And our mantra, I suppose, if you like, I mean, that makes it sound very grand, but it is really important, is to do something and not do nothing. And this is a real problem, because what happens is that people start down this road and just get bamboozled by all of this complexity and this idea of risk and the fact that they find it difficult to trust the right people. And as a consequence, do nothing. And just the money just stays in cash, quietly eroding over time. So my first advice would be to do something, not nothing. But my second thought would be that remember that the first thing you do probably won't be the last thing that you do. In other words, the first investment that you make probably won't be your last investment. So it doesn't need to be perfect. I mean, define perfect anyway. What is the perfect investment? But it doesn't need to be perfect. So starting with something that is, you know, quite generalist, is quite wide in its investment scope. So, you know, we talked about global investments, and starting small, not thinking about, I've got £15,000, let's put it all in this thing, but perhaps starting by dipping your toe in with maybe, let's just put £1,000 in now and just see how it works. Let's just get used to the process of investing. Let's see the flow of information I get. Let's see the price moving. Let's see how much I can sleep at night by having my £1,000 invested. Because, you know, you do need to be able to sleep at night. You don't want to be worrying about this. So, you know, start small and start with something general rather than something specific. Because what you will do over time is, you, by definition, you will learn. You know, you will see what's happening to your first investment. You will see how it's behaving. You'll see how it reacts to the way the world is changing. And then that's the opportunity to then think, right, okay, I've made my first investment. Where do I go from here? What are the things that I know about in the world, that I read about, that I see on the news, that are in the papers, that might then spark an idea of where my next investment might be? And maybe that is specializing in something like a specific geography. Maybe it's specializing in a specific asset class. So maybe, you know, you mentioned the more esoteric things, like you can now buy investments in song rights, in student accommodation, in wind farms. You know, you can really get into some very, very granular types of investment. And of course, that's where, to some extent, the investment trust structure really helps investors, because of the way the structure works. It allows investors to get into some really kind of niche parts of the market in a quite a sensible way, really. So start small, start generalist, and build from there is what I would say.
I have to say, I love that mantra, that idea of do something, not nothing. I think that's a really concise way to sort of think about these things. And I think it also ties in with the point you mentioned earlier as well, which is about time in the market, but not trying to time the market. Because I think sometimes some people think, oh gosh, is now the right time to do it? Yep. You know, should I be doing it? And it completely ties in with that point, as you were saying, about, you know, doesn't really matter about the time, just do something, not nothing. And also to say, I think it's an opportunity here about the point about the investment trust structure. You know, if you do want to find a bit more information about that, we did do a previous podcast, which is available. And that was with the head of investment trusts at Janice Henderson. It does also dive into a bit more about that element as well. So that is available for those looking to find out a bit more information on that. But I guess as well, so we've kind of talked about the ways to kind of get going and things for beginners to consider. What about pitfalls? And I guess then also following on from that, you know, is there a specific process as well?
Yeah, I mean, there's no one way of doing this, but there are two things you need to consider. And I would classify those as what and how. By what, I mean, what are you going to invest in? You know, you obviously have to think about that. And that really needs to be, to take a step back a little bit, really needs to be allied to some goals. You know, what is it you're trying to achieve? Over what time frame are you trying to achieve it? What is a reasonable rate of return? What is it that you're looking to get over time? So if you consider those things, and there's some stuff on the Steps website to help you think about goals, you know, we've got a whole step around goal setting and what you need to do in order to get into a position to invest. So for example, if you're paying off a credit card, for example, then I would suggest you do that before you consider investing. You know, get rid of those high cost credit exposures that you have, you know, loans, credit cards, those kinds of things, and get your finances on a firm footing first, so that you are in a good place to start. That's kind of the what. In terms of the how do you physically go about investing? Well, again, there's no one way. Where most people start is with an investment platform. So I mentioned Hargreaves Lansdown, they're the biggest, but there are others, many others actually. AJ Bell, Interactive Investor, the second and third largest. But there's a whole range of these people who are platforms that allow you to make all the decisions. So you open an account, which is an online process, usually can be done in a couple of minutes. You link it to your bank account so that the platform can take money from your bank account. And then you go into their, you know, they'll set your username and password, and you go into their platform. And then you've got the full array of investments in front of you, whether they are investment trusts or funds or ETFs or indeed individual companies as well, of course. And it is literally a case of going in, you know, finding the investment that you're interested in, telling the platform how many shares or how much money you want to invest, whether that's a regular monthly instruction. So all of these platforms now allow you to say, well, I just want to put £50 a month in, this, you know, invest it in this particular thing. Or it could be a lump sum, as we talked about. So maybe it is, you know, of my £15,000, I'm going to put 5,000 in this, 5,000 in that, and 5,000 in the other. And literally, it's as simple as pressing a few buttons, and there they are. The shares are in your portfolio, and you can see them online. You can look at them as frequently as you like. I would sort of counsel against looking at them at every minute of the day. I know I've just written a blog on this actually, because I've just done a review of my own pension, which is with Hargreaves Lansdown. And, you know, over the pandemic, it was far too tempting to be looking every day and just kind of seeing where it was. Really, you know, you don't need to look at it, you know, once a month would probably be too frequent. But it is tempting because you've got access. And of course, a lot of these people have apps as well. So you can literally just on your mobile, you can look at it through an app. That's it, really. I mean, you know, it is as simple as that. And the other thing to mention with platforms, of course, is that there are platforms out there that can give you a bit more help than just saying, there's the universe, off you go. And these broadly fall into a kind of category called robo-advisors. It's a slightly confusing term in the sense that they're not really actually giving you any advice. What they are doing is kind of digital wealth management. So for your £50 a month or whatever it is you're investing, they will put you in a portfolio of investments that meet a given criteria. And in most cases, it's risk. So you go on and you'll do like a little questionnaire, and they will help you assess your attitude to risk. You know, are you a conservative type who wants to take low risk, or are you sort of slightly more adventurous? I suppose I was going to say outrageous, but adventurous is the right adventurous is the right word. You know, have you, you know, do you want to take on a bit more risk with the potential of getting a bit more of a return? And then they will put you in a portfolio of investments, usually low cost exchange traded funds, that will then marry against your risk profile and move with you over time. So there are those two different types of platform.
Really interesting answer there, Simon. There's so much great things in there that I'd love to just unpick if I can over the next couple of questions. I mean, sure. The first one, you know, I really wanted to dive into a bit is, you mentioned, you know, things like ETFs, and obviously we've talked a bit about investment trusts and indeed open-ended funds, which can be referred to as OEICs as well. Some of these things as well, they're often referred to in the context of active versus passive.
Yes, that's right.
You know, so this idea of active being stock picking specifically and passive being, you know, sort of tracking the performance of an index. I just wondered if maybe you could talk to that a little bit more as well and kind of what your view is on it. Is one better than the other? Actually, is it a bit like conversation we were having earlier and that, you know, diversification is key? You know, what do you think?
Yeah, so active passive, it's a thing often debated. I suspect probably more debated by people in the industry than by investors, but it's a super important distinction because active and passive funds work in distinctly different ways. So as you said, for active, there's a fund manager involved. He or she is picking the investments that go in the portfolio, and you get active open-ended funds or OEICs, and you get active investment trusts or passive funds which don't have a fund manager involved, and they simply track a basket of shares. So an example might be a tracker fund or an exchange traded fund, which simply replicates what the biggest 100 companies in the UK are doing. The FTSE 100 is the index of the biggest 100 companies. And if the value of those 100 companies goes up, then your iShare, your tracker essentially would go up as well. Why is it important to understand the distinction? Well, one of the things is cost. So where there's a fund manager involved, those things tend to be more expensive because you're paying for the expertise of a fund manager. It's not usually just one person. It's usually a team of people that are involved in managing any given fund or investment trust. And because they aren't required for a tracker that is simply this kind of replicating of an index, they tend to be cheaper. It's worth saying that costs do have an impact on your returns. So if you've got something that's very, very expensive, it's going to have to work a whole lot harder to generate a return because the costs are coming out of the value of that investment before you get your return. But I would also say that cheap is not necessarily good. And one of the issues with trackers, because there's no distinction between what's a good and what's a bad investment, you get everything. And so if you are following the 100 biggest companies in the UK in your tracker, in your exchange traded fund or index fund, then some of those companies, some of the time, won't do very well. And in fact, the job of a fund manager is to be constantly managing that portfolio, you know, investing in the ones that they think will do well, selling the ones that they think aren't doing so well, and taking that, as the name implies, that active approach to managing the portfolio with the aim of getting the best returns and, of course, dealing with the fact that they are a little bit more expensive. So to answer your question, sorry, long answer to a short question, you know, is one better than the other? No, they're both important, and they can actually be used, both of them, in your portfolio as a blend. So you can take active investments, maybe a little bit more expensive, but where they are doing something that is slightly niche or where it demands the skill of fund management. And then you can blend that with a lower cost passive, which will then bring the overall cost of your portfolio down because you've got the two happening at the same time.
And this topic of cost as well, or, you know, you often hear, you know, about fees and charges and taxes and things. Again, that's a really interesting point for people to consider, isn't it? And, you know, you've mentioned a bit there about passives often being considered cheaper than active funds. What other aspects to these should people be aware of? I mean, again, when you were, you know, brilliantly explaining about how to get going and using a platform, you have to set things up there. You know, are there things that people need to consider fee-wise or charges-wise there as well?
Yeah.
Could you maybe comment a bit more on sort of the kind of cost and charges element as well?
Yeah, it's important, but don't get obsessed by it, because the problem with being obsessed by it, and I'm afraid lots of journalists seem to be obsessed by it, it gets written about so much, is that, again, you sort of lead to this paralysis and not doing anything because you're getting too involved in the detail. But in the same way that investments themselves, collective investments themselves have costs, so do platforms. And generally speaking, they are two different types of costs. One is for holding assets on that platform. So you might see it called a platform fee or an annual administration fee, annual management fee sometimes. And that's the fee that the platform charges for looking after your investments. And then there's the trading charges. And trading charges tend to be more expensive if you're doing it offline. So lots of services have got a telephone. You know, you can ring up and ask to buy shares via telephone. That tends to be more expensive than if you're doing it online. And it tends to be more expensive if you're doing bigger lump sum investments than you are, say, monthly regular investments. So lots of places will charge maybe £1.50, £2 for a regular monthly investment. Whereas if you're buying a bigger lump sum, it could be 10, 12, £15 per trade. Now, all of those charges add up. So it is worth taking them into account. But it's also worth thinking about what else your platform provides you with for the costs that you're paying. So some platforms out there are like the EasyJet type platforms, the Ryanairs of this world. So they're kind of the no-frills platforms. They're just trading and they really don't give you much beyond that. So something like iWeb actually would fit into that category. At the other end of the scale, you've got things like Hargreaves Lansdown, we mentioned a moment ago, or AJ Bell, Interactive Investor, which are going to be more expensive, but you're going to get a lot more for your money. You know, you're going to get pretty good telephone service. So when you ring up and ask a question, there's going to be somebody there who can help. But you're also going to get a lot of stuff in the website that is immensely helpful. So research tools, recommended investment lists, articles and videos about how to invest often are on these platforms too. So it is quite complicated, but it is worth thinking about what am I getting back in return, not just thinking about what the headline figure of cost is.
Sure, absolutely. And it sounds like as well, you know, there are a lot of, again, options available for people. So depending on their circumstances, you know, how involved they want to be with it and exactly, you know, what frills, I suppose, that they could kind of want, you know, there's a variety for people to consider and kind of go out and look into what could be the best option for them and for their investment journey. Absolutely. And I would just, I guess, as I mentioned earlier, you know, you worked in the financial services industry, you know, you have kind of the background and the experience in the space. And as you mentioned, you've recently done a blog post yourself, kind of with a review of your portfolio. Just kind of a bit of a fun question, really. You know, what was your first investment? What was, you know, can you tell us a bit about your experience getting into investing and what you did?
Yeah, of course. So very quick story. I graduated in English and film and media, so nothing to do with investing at all, or finance or business, and immediately got a job working for a company called Halifax Share Dealing, who are a platform. I was there as answering the telephones, taking deals from telephone customers. Telephone was much bigger than, this was the late 90s, bigger than the internet, of course. And it was a 6-month job. I ended up staying 10 years. And during the course of that job, we had a visit from some guys at Barclays Bank, who at the time owned the iShares brand. I mentioned it's subsequently gone to BlackRock. They sold it actually to BlackRock during the financial crisis. But Barclays at the time owned this iShares brand, and they came and presented to a number of us about iShares and what they did and why Halifax really should have iShares on their platform available to Halifax's customer base. And I remember thinking, wow, this is really interesting. This is a cheap and easy, understandable way to get into buying the biggest 100 companies. I was looking at the FTSE 100 tracker, buying the biggest 100 companies in the UK without me having to buy them all. You know, how, and I couldn't afford to buy them all. My first investment, I said it was a £50 a month investment into the iShares FTSE 100 tracker, thinking, you know, this is a ticket to all of these companies, many of which are actually not UK companies. They're really global companies because they're selling goods and services around the world for £50 a month. That's amazing. And that's how I got started. And actually, I haven't kept it all the way through. I've had periods where I've sold it and then rebought it. I did actually rebuy some during the pandemic. So it's still in my portfolio today.
But, I mean, and that's it, isn't it? It's quite, you know, it's an interesting kind of story in the sense of, you know, how to get going. And, you know, the point that you say there is, you know, you don't have to hold something all the way through. You obviously, there came a point, you made a decision, you're like, actually, I don't want this in my portfolio. It doesn't suit my needs right now. But then actually there's the opportunity to be able to get back into it or reinvest or buy again further down the line if it does kind of then meet those needs. And I guess, you know, obviously, as that investment journey's gone on, have you, I would assume, but, you know, diversified a bit more and added, you know, potentially Absolutely. Sort of investment trusts, you know, other ETFs or open-ended funds as well? And was that just, you know, from taking that first step, were you able to then go, okay, I want to, you know, maybe have a specific exposure, or was it actually to have access to that active management like we were discussing earlier?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. So I started with this exchange-traded fund. I then looked at, because this was the time of kind of the dot-com boom, right? So people around me were buying shares in individual companies, and they would list on the stock market. Their price would go up, you know, 100% on the first day, and they would sell out, and you know, they'd be buying, you know, bottles of champagne. And I thought, well, that's, you know, that do I really want to get into that? Do I really want to take that risk? Because for every company that listed and did well, there was also another company that listed and then disappeared within about 15 minutes. So I then discovered investment trusts. I discovered open-ended funds. And I did buy a couple of individual companies back then. And I still have now in my portfolio a couple of individual companies. But what happens with these, and it's interesting, lots of people tell similar stories where, you know, a mate says, oh, I work for such and such a company. You should buy some shares in our company. It's really good. And you do. And then it isn't. And, you know, you end up regretting it. So I moved quite heavily into investment trusts because I like the idea of active management. I thought that was a good thing. But I also like the idea that investment trusts, well, two things really. One is around the independent board. That really, for me, was a fascinating idea, that a board independent of the fund manager is playing that kind of governance and oversight role. You know, they're keeping an eye on what the fund manager is doing. And, you know, it's been highlighted, you know, there have been a couple of instances recently where the value of boards has really kind of come to the fore. And I think that was an important factor. But I also like the fact that most investment trusts are able to use something called gearing, which is this idea of borrowing money to invest. Because providing the fund manager is you know, doing that sensibly and is finding investments that can return more than the cost of that borrowing, because obviously borrowing money comes at cost, then they can boost returns for shareholders. And I thought that was a fascinating facet, really, of an investment trust. So when you compare an investment trust that buys shares in the FTSE 100 with a tracker that buys shares in the FTSE 100, if the manager is of the investment trust is using gearing effectively, then you would expect to see a better return from the investment trust, even taking into account the investment trust is likely to have higher costs because the manager is using that skill and judgment to deploy the borrowing and get a better return for shareholders. Of course, it's worth saying that gearing is a double-edged sword. If they get it wrong, then it will exacerbate losses. But skillful use of gearing was interesting. And then I think, you know, the other thing, and I haven't until recently been a particularly income focused investor. I've been looking for sort of growth in my investments. But the other thing about investment trust is that smoothness of income. You know, open-ended funds, they do pay income, and they sometimes pay, you know, lots of income, but it tends to go up and down because of the fact that they are forced to pay out all of the income that they get from their underlying portfolio, where investment trusts can squirrel a bit away. They can squirrel away 15% each year. And then that means that there's a very smooth payment of income, of dividend income. And I think that is actually quite an appealing factor for an investment trust as well. So yeah, my portfolio now is a very small percentage of individual companies that have been recommended to me by friends going nowhere, or I'm looking to sell. I do have some exchange-traded funds. I do have some open-ended funds, but I would say probably, I don't know, 60-70% of my portfolio now is investment trust.
And I think, you know, you raise a really good point there about the income, and, you know, I could go on and talk about this, you know, all day, but I won't, I promise. But, you know, as we've referred to a few times throughout our conversation, you know, last year in particular, the impact of the pandemic, obviously, in many, many ways was completely unprecedented and extraordinary. And we saw, particularly with regards to income, what happened to a number of companies, you know, whether their regulators had, you know, kind of forced them to suspend payments of them, or indeed other companies perhaps thinking, okay, this is a chance for us to, you know, rebase or reset, you know, the level of dividend that we're paying and things as well. So as an investor, as a shareholder, if you were in an investment trust, you know, we saw that they were able to benefit from that ability that you so rightly highlighted of being able to kind of smooth the dividends over for shareholders. And again, as you pointed out, all being kind of overseen by that independent board of directors who do strive to make sure that the fund's being run in the best way for all the shareholders. years. And I guess my very last question, if I may, Simon, is you touched on very briefly again in that brilliant description about getting going and getting started on platforms and not being tempted to hit the refresh button on your portfolio kind of every hour of every day. You know, how do you keep in touch with that? You know, you touched on the fact that, you know, maybe once a month might be too much. Or is there a set period of time? You know, is it just a case of just keeping an eye on it every now and then? Is it when you're thinking about your own decisions in terms of what's coming next in your life, that kind of thing? What can you kind of advise?
I don't think there's any right or wrong answer to this. And let's face it, if you wanted to look at your portfolio every day, there's nothing to stop you doing it. And as I said, providing you can sleep for long enough at night, then that's good. But let's not forget that these all investing really is, as we said, is about the long term, at least 5 years, preferably 10 or more. And so, you know, if you were to employ the services of a financial advisor, for example, to help you with your financial planning, with your tax situation, with choosing investments, then they will do a review with you at least once a year. And, you know, that seems, in normal market circumstances, I would say that seems like a fairly sensible time frame, because you need to give time to your investments to grow and to do their thing, really. And, you know, not to panic when markets go down. I mean, I wrote about this at the time in March last year, when we saw those huge falls in markets. You know, the sensible investor would say, actually, that's an opportunity to buy. This was a great investment at £10. Now it's at £5. Let's buy some more. And it takes nerves of steel to do that. You know, you've really got to, you know, have confidence in the investment that you're making. But, you know, those opportunities do present themselves in times of market volatility, when prices are moving wildly. In normal circumstances, you know, in normal markets, if there is such a thing, but when you're not dealing with a financial crisis or a pandemic, for example, then annually would probably be frequently enough. What you will find is if you open an account with a platform, they're going to send you a statement anyway, at least once a year, to show you where your investments are. If you're in funds and investment trusts, and indeed exchange traded funds, they will publish a monthly fact sheet, almost always monthly, some quarterly, but almost always monthly, which is a way of just looking at what that investment has done in a short period of a month. Of course, they also report longer term performance, but it gives you what's been happening. And often fund managers either write commentaries or create videos telling investors, you know, I've bought this, I've sold this, this is why I've done it. I suppose the final thing to mention for specifically for investment trust investors actually is the annual report, which is published, as you might guess, annually, once a year. But that document really is a Bible when it comes to fully understanding your investment, because the chairman of the investment trust, the fund manager, will write about how the investment has performed and what it's doing. The accounts will be presented so you can see in pounds, shillings and pence what has been happening. And they will give an outlook. You know, they'll give an outlook on what they think is going to be happening for the coming year. And many investment trusts, actually, and I know Janice Henderson do this, will facilitate investors in those trusts coming along either virtually or in person to the annual general meeting, which is an opportunity. And it's I would counsel anyone to do this if they had the chance. It's an opportunity to quiz the board and quiz the fund manager about what they've been doing. And you as a shareholder get to hold them accountable for the actions they've taken. And that is a, you know, it's in my view, it's way too little used. You know, people just don't do it so much. But it's an opportunity you shouldn't forsake if you've got the opportunity to do it, I would say.
Simon, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. Thanks so much for coming in and having this conversation. And yes, it's so much interesting information there. You know, great to hear about Steps to Investing in and what you're up to. So
thank you. Great questions.
So really enjoyed chatting with you, Simon. Thank you for your time. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, review, and share this with anyone you think will also find it interesting. If you'd like more information on Janice Henderson Managed Investment Trusts, please visit the Janice Henderson website. And for more information about learning to invest, please visit stepstoinvesting.com. Glossary terms. Active investing. An investment approach where a fund manager actively takes decisions about which and what proportion of investments to hold, often with the goal of outperforming a specific index. It relies on a fund manager's investment skill, the opposite of passive investing. Absolute return. The total return of a portfolio, as opposed to its relative return against a benchmark. It is measured as a gain or loss and stated as a percentage of a portfolio's total value. Diversification. A way of spreading risk by mixing different types of assets or asset classes in a portfolio. It is based on the assumption that the prices of the different assets will behave differently in a given scenario. Assets with low correlations should provide the most diversification. Inflation. The rate at which the prices of goods and services are rising in an economy. The CPI and RPI are two common measures, the opposite of deflation. Leverage. The use of borrowing to increase exposure to an asset or market. This can be done by borrowing cash and using it to buy an asset, or by using financial instruments such as derivatives to simulate the effect of borrowing for further investment in assets. Exchange-traded funds, or ETFs. A security that tracks an index, such as an index of equities, bonds, or commodities. ETFs trade like an equity on a stock exchange and experience price changes as the underlying assets move up and down in price. ETFs typically have higher daily liquidity and lower fees than actively managed funds. Fiscal stimulus. Government policy relating to setting tax rates and spending levels. It is separate from monetary policy, which is typically set by a central bank. Fiscal austerity refers to raising taxes and or cutting spending in an attempt to reduce government debt. Fiscal expansion, or stimulus, refers to an increase in government spending and or a reduction in taxes. Investment trusts. A publicly quoted company that invests its shareholders' money in the shares of other companies. It has a fixed number of shares. Illiquid assets. Securities that cannot be easily bought or sold in the market. For example, shares with a high market capitalization are typically liquid, as there are often a large number of willing buyers and sellers in the market. Liquid assets. Securities that can be easily bought or sold in the market. Open-ended, or OEIC. An open-ended investment company. This is a common structure for UK domiciled funds. Most are UCITS compliant. Passive. An investment approach that tracks an index. It is called passive because it simply seeks to replicate the index. Many exchange-traded funds are passive funds, the opposite of active investing. Savings ratio. The savings rate is a measurement of the amount of money, expressed as a percentage or ratio, that a person deducts from their disposable personal income to set aside as a nest egg or for retirement. Value-based investing. Value investors search for companies that they believe are undervalued by the market and therefore expect their share price to increase. One of the favored techniques is to buy companies with low price to earnings, also known as PE, ratios. See also growth investing. Volatility. The rate and extent at which the price of a portfolio, security or index, moves up and down. If the price swings up and down with large movements, it has high volatility. If the price moves more slowly and to a lesser extent, it has lower volatility. It is used as a measure of the riskiness of an investment. Gearing, a measure of a company's leverage that shows how far its operations are funded by lenders versus shareholders. It is a measure of the debt level of a company. Within investment trusts, it refers to how much money the trust borrows for investment purposes. Before investing in an investment trust referred to in this podcast, you should satisfy yourself as to its suitability and the risks involved. You may wish to consult a financial advisor. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The value of an investment and the income from it can fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested. Nothing in this podcast is intended or should be construed as advice. This podcast is not a recommendation to sell or purchase any investment. It does not form part of any contract for the sale or purchase of any investment. References made to individual securities should not constitute or form part of any offer or solicitation to issue, sell, subscribe, or purchase the security. Janus Henderson Investors, one of its affiliate advisors or its employees, may have a position mentioned in the securities mentioned in this podcast. Issued in the UK by Janus Henderson Investors. Janus Henderson Investors is the name under which investment products and services are provided by Janus Capital International Limited. Registration number 359-4615. Henderson Global Investors Limited, registration number 906355. Henderson Investment Funds Limited, registration number 2678531. Henderson Equity Partners Limited, registration number 2606646. Each registered in England and Wales at 201 Bishopsgate, London, EC2M 3AE, and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. And Henderson Management SA, registration number B22848 at 2 Rue de Bitburg, L-1273, Luxembourg, and regulated by the Commission de Surveillance du Secteur Financier. Janice Henderson, Janice Henderson, Perkins, Intech, Velocity Shares, Knowledge Shared, Knowledge Shared, and Knowledge Labs are trademarks of Janice Henderson Group PLC or one of its subsidiaries. Copyright Janice Henderson Group PLC.